Welcome to the SEI podcast series, a production of Carnegie Mellon University's Software Engineering Institute. The SEI is a federally funded research and development center sponsored by the Department of Defense and operated by Carnegie Mellon University. A transcript of today's podcast is available at sei.cmu.edu/podcasts. My name is Eileen Rubel, and I'm the initiative lead for the SEI's Continuous Lifecycle Solutions Initiative. With me today is Grace Lewis, who is a principal researcher here at the SEI, and also the lead of our Tactical Technologies Group initiative. Grace leads our research in tactical edge computing and also security for the Internet of Things. To put it another way, Grace's work helps soldiers and sensors stay securely connected while on the battlefield. This interview is part of our new podcast series that we're launching, highlighting the work of women in the fields of software and cybersecurity. Welcome.
Thank you.
Grace, let's start by having you tell us a little bit about yourself and your role here at the SEI, and specifically, what do you mean when you talk about edge computing? How does your work get used in the field?
Okay, like you said before, I lead a group called the Tactical Technologies Group. What we do is we develop technologies for people that operate in the field. Soldiers, first responders, medics, but just technologies that can help them do their job better. Tactical edge computing, which is my area of research, it's about pushing cloud resources to the edge. It's about giving people that are in the field access to the cloud or something like the cloud, even if they're not fully connected to the cloud. So like just like when you travel, you pack a suitcase. So what these folks do is they pack a cloudlet or a server. They put everything that they need there for their mission, data, maps, computing, everything that they need. And so once these cloudlets are deployed in the field, then they can access these resources from their mobile devices. More recently, I've been working on IoT security or security for the Internet of Things, where the idea there is to be able to use these cloudlets also as collection points for sensors and actuators in the field. And with the research that I'm doing right now, the goal is to be able to know if these devices are compromised in any way.
Okay.
That's basically what I'm doing now.
Okay, that's really cool.
It is cool.
So can we go back into the Wayback Machine and talk about your early experiences? How did you find your way into software engineering? Were you really good at math as a kid?
Okay, I'm going to date myself right now.
But
it was back in 1983. I come from a Hispanic family, and in Hispanic families, turning 15 is a big deal. Especially for girls, but it's a big deal. And, you know, most people want big parties or big trips or big dresses. I wanted a computer. And that's what I got for my 15th birthday. I thought it was, you know, the coolest thing ever. Some friends had it. I had seen my friends' houses. I had seen them on TV. But this was my own. This is my own personal computer, which was a big deal back in 1983. It was an IBM PC. I was fascinated. I taught myself BASIC, and the way I did it, which is kind of backwards, is that I don't remember the name of this magazine, but they had this magazine that would have code snippets in them, in BASIC, and I would take the code snippets and I would just transcribe them in my editor, and boop, out came a program, and I was just fascinated. You know, like, wow, I wrote this and I can get it to do that. And so I would start tweaking things. I went, what if I change this? What if I change that? And, you know, I taught myself BASIC. All of a sudden, I know how to do that. And so that's how I got into computers. As far as math and science, yes, I like math and science. I did well in math and science. As a matter of fact, you know how those assignments when you're growing up where they say you draw yourself as you what you would do in the future?
Right.
My drawing would always be me in a lab coat in a lab with test tubes and beakers for some reason. But that was me growing up. I thought I was going to be a scientist, or at least that's my perception of a scientist. But once I found computers, it was like, no. This is what I want to do. I think what was the most attractive for me was the creative process. I found it just so creative. And that's really what sold me. And this is where I do what I do.
That's great. Did you encounter any roadblocks along the way? And if you did, how did you address them?
I wouldn't say any roadblocks. I think the good thing for me is that my parents were really so supportive of everything I did. There was nothing, they never said, no, you can't do that, or oh, that's way above your age level or anything. You know, again, dating myself, I was probably 10 years old and I would balance the checkbook. I know you don't do this anymore, but I was the one that balanced the checkbook, and nobody ever told me not to do it. And it's just, so I never encountered roadblocks in that sense. But I do think there are roadblocks for women in general. I'm still shocked, you know, by the fact that if you, for example, if you're female, there is no way you could be a scientist or an engineer. Or, for example, I get these really, you know, nice email messages that say, Dr. Lewis, blah, 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 blah. And then halfway through, I realize they think I'm a man. Yep. Just because you have that, you know, that title. Or just, for example, going sometimes, I remember going to conferences or going to meetings even, and people handing me things, oh, can you go make a copy of this? Because, and then they're shocked, right? Because the main speaker, Grace Lewis, and they are like, oh my gosh, I totally screwed that one up. But that still happens.
Yeah.
And to me, that is shocking. That is shocking. Probably the worst story that I can share is I was picking up my son at CCD class, and the CCD teacher said to me, your son is very bright. Your husband must be so intelligent. Yes, it made me mad. But what it made me think about is, what if that was my mom? What if my mom would have said, oh, no, you can't be a scientist, or you can't be intelligent or whatever. You can't do that because you're female. And I think that's the major roadblock still for women, which is sad. It's the belief that there are men things and there are women things, and science and engineering is not a woman thing. So I think that we really have to start educating parents and teachers. That's who we should be educating, because so they start making the, you know, doing the male-female
right.
thing and gender things. But that's really, to me, that is the only roadblock that is still out there for women. I was very fortunate because my parents were extremely supportive, and also my teachers. But I do understand that not everybody has that luxury.
That there's still this gendered representation,
right.
even in things like math problems.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
The
yes.
doctors are represented
yes.
as men.
And, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
So you recently, on one of our SEI podcasts, mm-hmm. you interviewed Carol Fries and Jaria Quesenberry mm-hmm. about recruiting women into mm-hmm. the computer science
yeah.
department
yeah.
here at CMU.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked a little bit about your own experience in the master's program. I'm wondering if you would share that with us again.
Sure. So as I said before, I'm a first-generation American. My parents are Hispanic. They came here in the 60s looking for the American dream, just like many people back then. When I was 17, my parents divorced, mm-hmm. and I moved to Colombia, which is where my family's from, to live with my mom's family. It was only supposed to be a year and a half while I finished high school, and I ended up staying there for 12 years because I absolutely loved it. I loved it. I love it being close to family. I love the experience. So when I started my undergraduate program there, it was called Software Systems Engineering, not quite computer science or software engineering, like a mix of the two. I was in a 50-50 class, and that was actually very common, 50-50. And so to me, that was like, that's how it is everywhere. You know, it's always 50-50. I understand from what I heard that things are changing there as well, but back then it was 50-50. So after 12 years, I came back to the U.S., came back to CMU, to the Master's of Software Engineering program, and I walk into orientation, and I look around, and I'm the only woman there. I later found out there was another one. So it was two of us in a group of about 35. And so I started asking, I'm like, is this normal? And everybody's like, yep, it's normal. And I'm like, wow, that's different for me. That's mm-hmm. shocking. I'm so used to something completely different. So I'm walking around campus one day, and I see this flyer, and it says, new group starting on campus, women at SCS. I'm like, this is where they are. So I said, I have to be there. But I wanted to be there, but especially because I wanted to make a difference, because I kept thinking, the few females that are here have to have the same experience that I had, you
right.
know, a 50-50 kind of group, and they're not getting that. I'm sure there's a way we can make a difference. So I joined the group. I'm actually one of the founding members of Women at SCS. I got to work with Lenore Blum and also Carol Fries, just absolutely wonderful people. And those are definitely my favorite memories from back then. The group started because that was the very first year that they had admitted a large group of women. And basically the dean told Lenore, we have a lot of women coming in, which is absolutely great. We have to create an environment where they
right.
feel welcome, they feel comfortable, and you know, we have to make them stay, was basically what
right.
she was told. And that's how the group started. And I remember those days, and now going to campus, and it's such a different experience. You see so many women in
yes.
computer science. 50% for a couple of years in a row, I want to say 3 years in a row. And that is in part to Lenore Blum, Carol Fries, and now Juria, who they just published a book. It's called Kicking Butt in Computer Science, the CMU Story, or something like that. And with data, they demonstrate how the key is just changing the culture. It's changing the culture. It's making it seem just normal. And it's absolutely wonderful what they've done. I really admire the work that they've done.
That's great. Mm-hmm. And that's such a great story. Thanks for sharing the early years of women at SCS.
Yeah,
I really enjoyed hearing about that.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I think that our listeners are always interested in is, how do you stay current? What mm-hmm. kinds of resources are you looking at, you know, on a mm-hmm. daily or regular mm-hmm. basis to stay mm-hmm. on top of your field?
So to stay on top of things, I really start my day by saying, at least, even if it's just 10 minutes, I subscribe to a couple of newsletters and I get them in the morning. One is InfoWorld, the other one is Wired. Even if I don't read them, you know, like everything, I at least see, okay, these are the new things, this is what is going on. So I definitely do that. There are also a couple of publications that I read more like on a yearly basis, like Gartner's Hype Cycle for Emerging Technologies, just, you know, just to see what is out there. That's something I read. There are other things like that. But really the way I keep on top of things is actually by doing service work, which to me, it's like, what is it, killing two birds with one stone, is that the saying? Because I get asked to be on program committees, and where you review papers, or for example, to review manuscripts submitted to journals. And I know it's a lot of work, and you know, when the deadline is coming, I'm like, why did I do this? But it's really forces me. It forces me to stay on top of things, because you know, if you're gonna look at a piece of work, well, you better right. know what you're talking about, right? So it really forces me to keep, so I use that as a forcing function. As far as books, I am very, very, I don't know, I protect my me time and my family time very much. So when I read books, they're for fun. They're not technical. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's also very important, being able to separate the two. You know, when I leave here, I try my best to go home, and it's family time and it's me time, and
right.
not to mix it to things. So when I read books, it's really for fun.
Okay, great. Looking ahead, where do you see your work, you know, related to IoT and edge computing going, you know, maybe in the next 5 years?
Actually, they're going to come together. They're going to come together, and they're already coming together, because the thing is that IoT devices in the field or anywhere, mm-hmm. they're collecting so much data. And you can't expect any network in the world to be able to handle all that data as it's going to the cloud, because that's where people want to send that data, right? Going to the cloud so it can be processed, shared. And so where edge computing comes in is, imagine if you had these clouds, for example, deployed at the edge, deployed close to those IoT devices. They're doing all the pre-processing, all the analysis, and so what's sent to the cloud is really what really matters, not all the raw data, but processed data. So I see them coming together very, very, very nicely.
Okay, great. If you could give us one piece of advice to, you know, a young mm-hmm. person that's mm-hmm. that's looking to, you know, follow your journey right. into the field, what would you tell them?
To let go of stereotypes. I mean, it's to me, that's the big thing. I mean, I give talks at schools and things like that, and one of the big questions I usually get is like, is it really just all about coding and being in and you know, it's no, it's not actually. It's not. Sure, it's where you start, because that's where kind of like where the love starts, right? Oh, I like mm-hmm. coding, but it's just breaking those stereotypes. I mean, there is so much more that I do that it's not coding, because it's not. I mean, coding is just like the tool, right? It's really about
right.
you know, changing the world. I mean, the code that is being written nowadays, it's self-driving cars, it's being able to do all these, you know, data visualizations, taking education to, you know, parts in the world that don't have access to the internet or things like that. So it's really yes, there is programming, but it's not that stereotype. It's not the, I don't know, it's not the male with the glasses and the pocket protector. I mean, those are stereotypes. It's so
right.
different. I mean, just walk around at CMU, you'll see it's a really it's very, very different. So it's really that. It's breaking those stereotypes. It's more than just programming. It's really just about what you do is eventually going to change the world in some way. And to me, that's the big thing.
So thinking about really, what is your purpose? What are you coding for? What
exactly.
kind of thing are you trying to achieve mm-hmm. to leave the world better than you
mm-hmm.
found it?
Sounds good.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today,
Grace.
I really appreciate it. This podcast is available on the SEI website at sei.cmu.edu/podcasts and on Carnegie Mellon University's iTunes site, the SEI's YouTube channel, and SoundCloud. As always, if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to email us at info@sei.cmu.edu. Thanks.